ends up. I opened the window and influenza. I opened the window. I opened the window and influenza.
Oh, this is the real BS show. And we've got a show for you this week. Wow.
Yeah.
Everybody's talking about the coronavirus.
Right.
So when I was checking around, I saw this 1918 called the killer virus.
Right.
And then later it got a nickname, Spanish virus.
Yeah, we covered that in the last show.
So I started looking at it and learning more about it and more about it. Holy catfish, I couldn't believe what I was reading.
Right.
It was unbelievable. I mean, you take World War I and World War II, put them together in the flu.
Right.
In 1918, beat them both.
Right.
That's just unbelievable. And what governments did to hide it.
Right. Or blame other people.
Well, try to blame Hitler. Yeah, Bayer aspirins. And,
right.
Because that's where Bayer come from, in Germany, and probably still do.
I think that was important to include that in the last show because people are paranoid and panicking. And, we can always go back in history and look back.
Well,
I
don't blame them now that I see what happened back then. Holy smokes.
Right.
You'd have symptoms in the morning.
Right.
And by that night, you were dead.
Yeah, that's the truth.
I mean, it wasn't just reserved for the old folks and the little guys. It hit the 20 to 40 age group really hard.
They were too healthy. Their bodies, the white blood cells are healthy, and the virus comes in.
They overcompensated.
Yeah, they kicked an overdrive, and that caused...
So they couldn't breathe.
Right.
Yeah, their lungs filled up with water, and it was just amazing. But, I mean, the speed with which it spread is just unbelievable.
So you found this... You went down the rabbit hole a little bit studying this and starting to find a holy cow, why didn't you know about it kind of thing.
Yeah,
you know?
I mean, all through school and all through, I mean, I know about the guys walking on the moon and Kennedy getting shot and, you know, this and that, who won the World Series, you know, in 1959.
Right.
You know, the Dodgers. But I never, ever, I mean, why don't they talk about it? Why? It's just like it never happened almost.
I remember studying about it in school. It was a minor one day topic, and I remember thinking, what? This actually happened? 50 million people to more, possibly more than that, died. And so I was very
In 1 year.
Yeah. I when I was younger, I was very fascinated in World War I history because World War I kind of defined the 20th century, and
it was very ugly. Yeah,
it was ugly. But World War II came about because of World War I. You know, a lot of resentment, and then the disease. When I started studying that and thinking, you know, my family came here in 1920 on my father's side, and they were going through all that. They were like, you know, seeing all the the horrid things going on.
It was still going in 1920. Matter of fact,
and so it's like amazing to me that they came through this to escape what was going on all around the world. That's something most people, I would say, definitely do not know about the Spanish flu, or maybe we should call it the Kansas flu.
Kansas, yeah, really. I mean, very possible. I mean, they don't even really know for sure.
No.
It was going on in China in 1917.
Right.
And so it could have been from China. I mean, the only reason they call it the Spanish flu is because Spain was the only one not in World War One, and they talked about it.
Right, they reported
Everybody else was not allowed to talk about it.
Yeah, they denied
it. They
didn't
want nobody to know that their people were dying. And,
right.
They didn't want to give away troop strength or anything like that.
You know?
Ridiculous. I mean, jeez.
Right.
I mean, the people were worried about getting arrested if they spoke about it.
Right.
And so...
Isn't that kind of funny that's happening now with the coronavirus? That happened with that doctor in China.
Right. China tried to do the same thing. They tried to subdue it, and he saw the need, and he spoke out, and boy, they got after him. Mm-hmm. Next thing you know, he's dead.
I'm hearing reports of other doctors in the beginning tried warning as well, and they were censored.
From China?
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah, right. That government control, you know, that good old government.
Right.
Well, you know, I'm so shocked at this 1918 killer virus, really, that swept around the world that fast.
Right.
I on the way here, I stopped at Walmart. I loaded up. I got a year's worth of toilet paper, probably 6 months worth of ding-dongs. I didn't, you know. But ding-dongs last forever, so, right. I mean, you can drop them down behind the refrigerator.
And did you try to get hand sanitizer?
Yeah, well, the shelves were clean. Yeah. There was none there. I said, what about Germex, you know? Nope, it's gone. It's on order, but we ain't got none.
Yeah, it's the same thing in California, almost every western state here, you know, East Coast. Everybody's just panic buying.
Yeah, well, I'm talking Titusville. I mean, what the heck?
Right, yeah. Hey, this is the reality, you know. I mean, I
saw people with masks on too.
Yeah, I believe it.
One older lady, she had a dust mask on.
Yeah,
it was like what you use for maybe painting or something, right. You know, in a factory.
Right.
I mean, that thing is. You go to the salad bar. What are you going to do?
Yeah, does she look like Hannibal Lecter with that on or something?
I don't know. It just, you know. It's like, oh, come on. Maybe she's protecting me from her.
Man, that's a possibility.
In case she sneezes or something.
Right.
Nah, I don't think so.
Snot
and everything all inside her dust mask, then what?
I recognize how fast the coronavirus spread. I think there's too much panic, though, for what it really is.
I have no idea, and I guess we're going to find out shortly.
I mean, we talked about it in our last show, you know, the R-naught factor and everything.
Yeah.
And the Spanish flu trumps this by far, trumps the coronavirus.
Well, right now the coronavirus is trumping the regular flu.
That's true.
Even though a lot of people die every year from it,
right,
it's still spreading faster than the
right. But
regular flu,
as we're going to talk about this the 1918 influenza H1N1 that first came, I mean
it was like
it this is the worst,
unbelievable
in the modern age, we'll say.
Yeah, it's just I'm astounded. I mean, history is there for a reason. You know?
Oh, sure.
You don't learn from it, you're going to do it. But why, after all these years? I mean, in 1918, they didn't have microscopes strong enough to see what was causing it. You know?
Right.
I mean, they couldn't magnify that much to see a virus or... I get the two mixed up. There's one they could see and there's one they couldn't see because it was too much smaller than...
The virus is probably the one they couldn't see. It's much more smaller.
And bacteria they could see?
Yes, yeah, because it's a cell, whereas a virus is basically an RNA.
Really small.
Yeah,
small.
And it takes over DNA, or it takes over a cell. But the influenza, they knew it was a disease, but they just couldn't identify what it was. And they knew it was there's many different influenzas, virus strains.
Right.
But this is one that definitely came out of the left.
Well,
the woodwork.
Let's share some history about the 1918 flu and how drastically bad it was.
Right.
And we'll try to drum it home. And then after we're done, let's because before 1918, you said that there was a lot of things going on, and probably all of this just keeps mutating and keeps changing, and that's, you know, it got real bad in 1918, but. Before that, there was, well, I don't know, Black Plague. And
yeah, oh, yeah, but that's a different one, though. There are all these different viruses and bacteria.
Well, that's what I mean.
Yeah.
You know, they could have all just mutated and become something else, you know,
right.
50 years or 100 years later or something.
Right.
Who knows? I don't know. I don't know much or nothing about that, but I'm sure you seem to know more about it. So
right.
We'll talk about that after we're done with the killer virus of 1918.
Right.
Okay, so let's hear another, let's hear some history.
Okay.
People didn't want to believe that they could be healthy in the morning and dead by nightfall. They didn't want to believe that.
It was the worst epidemic this country has ever known. It killed more Americans than all the wars this century combined.
It was a phantom, and we didn't know where it was.
In a gradual, remorseless way, it kept moving closer and closer.
You never knew from day to day who was going to be next on the death list. there were so many people dying that you ran out of things that you'd never considered running out of before, caskets.
Before it was over, it almost broke America apart.
I remember my mother putting a white sheet, a white piece of cloth over his face, and they closed the casket.
In 1918, the United States was a vigorous young nation, leading the world into the modern age. All our fears and anxieties were directed toward Europe, where the war raged. At home, we were safe. William Maxwell was growing up in Lincoln, Illinois.
In 1918, Lincoln was a town of 12,000 people. It was perhaps 50 years old, just time enough for the trees to mature so that the branches met over the sidewalks. The yards were large, and children played in clusters in the summer evenings. On Sunday morning, the church bells were pretty to hear, but my father had had enough of church going, so we went fishing on Sunday out in the country with a picnic. It was a life not very much impinged on by the outside world.
In Macon, Georgia, Catherine Giler was 5 years old.
My father was a playmate, actually, and when he'd take me out in his car, he would stop at a grocery store that he knew and take me in. And the owner of the store, in his white uniform, would say to his men, "Go out and shake the candy tree, boys." I think I must have known that candy didn't grow on that tree, but I wouldn't have given up the notion because he was enjoying it, and I was enjoying it, and everybody was enjoying it, you see.
For a young newspaper woman in Denver, Catherine Ann Porter, life was like a romantic novel.
I had a job on the Rocky Mountain News. The city editor put me to covering theaters. I met a boy, an army lieutenant. We were much in love.
The soldier was the darling of America. Patriotism ran unrestrained in a country newly entered in the Great War.
We would march up the streets singing, "Tramp, tramp, tramp, the boys are marching. I spied Kaiser at the door, and we'll get a lemon pie and we'll squash him in his eye, and there won't be any Kaiser anymore."
It was a good world, but it was an age of innocence. We really didn't know what was ahead.
Some say it began in the spring of 1918, when soldiers at Fort Riley, Kansas, burned tons of manure. A gale kicked up. A choking dust storm swept out over the land. A stinging, stinking yellow haze. The sun went dead black in Kansas. 2 days later, on March 11th, 1918, an Army private reported to the camp hospital before breakfast. He had a fever, sore throat, headache, nothing serious. 1 minute later, another soldier showed up. By noon, the hospital had over 100 cases. In a week, 500. That spring, 48 soldiers, all in the prime of life, died at Fort Riley. The cause of death was listed as pneumonia. The sickness then seemed to disappear, leaving as quickly as it had come. For over a century, the booming science of medicine had gone from one triumph to another. Researchers had developed vaccines for many diseases. Smallpox, anthrax, rabies, diphtheria, meningitis.
With the great advances in microbiology, we were eliminating mysteries, okay? The mystery of what causes this disease, the mystery of what causes this disease. The optimism of being able to visualize something, all we have to do is just look under the microscope and we'll see the organism and then take an action and see that something die off or be controlled. That leads to the thought of invincibility.
It seemed that the masters of medicine could control life and death. There was nothing that Americans couldn't do. We could even win the war that no one could win. That summer and fall, over 1.5 million Americans crossed the Atlantic for war. But some of those doughboys came from Kansas, and they'd brought something with them, a tiny, silent companion. Almost immediately, the Kansas sickness resurfaced in Europe. American soldiers got sick. English soldiers, French, German. As it spread, the microbe mutated, day by day, becoming more and more deadly. By the time the silent traveler came back to America, it had become a relentless killer. On a rainy day in September, Dr. Victor Vaughn, acting Surgeon General of the Army, received urgent orders. Proceed to a base near Boston called Camp Devens. Devens was about to change Dr. Vaughn's world forever.
I saw hundreds of young, stalwart men in uniform coming into the wards of the hospital. Every bed was full, yet others crowded in. The faces wore a bluish cast. A cough brought up the blood-stained sputum.
On the day that Vaughn arrived, 63 men died at Camp Devens. An autopsy revealed lungs that were swollen, filled with fluid, and strangely blue. Doctors were stunned. What in the name of God was happening to these lungs? When the strange new disease was finally identified, it turned out to be a very old and familiar one. Influenza, the flu. But it was unlike any flu that anyone had ever seen.
One of the factors that made this so particularly frightening was that everybody had a preconception of what the flu was. It's a miserable cold, and after a few days, you're up and around. This was a flu that put people into bed as if they'd been hit with a 2x4, that turned into pneumonia, that turned people blue and black and killed them. It was a flu out of some sort of a horror story. They never had dreamed that influenza could ever do anything like this to people before.
All right, there's chapter one, trying to explain the killer virus, the 1918, which is just stunning to me that I never heard of it till now.
50 million plus... 50 million plus died. 150 million got it.
That's amazing. Simply amazing. And like you said, there was a lot of history before that.
Oh, sure.
But I don't know what to say about it. I mean, it's just so amazing to me that
a lot of your relatives and my relatives died from it.
My grandma never told me nothing about it. And she lived through it.
Right.
You know, she was there. I never heard nothing from anybody about it,
right.
You know. It
right.
was like it's like it never happened.
Right.
But holy cow. And, I mean, 50 million people back then was a lot of people.
Oh, sure.
You know, I mean, I don't know what the population is now, but it's probably 10 times what it was then.
Easily. It's probably about 2 billion people.
Yeah.
So it's 7 billion now, so it's double, 2.5 times what it was then.
Now, as of today, the count I saw was well over 3,000 dead.
Sure.
From the coronavirus, and there was probably almost 100,000 cases diagnosed so far.
Right.
And they don't even have the kits out yet.
it's about 3% right now, but there's a lot of people not diagnosed yet. So probably the percent is lower for the mortality rate.
I mean, if I had a flu symptoms or whatever, where would I go? Where would I go to find out if I had the coronavirus?
Right now, the
I mean, does Titusville Hospital have a...
No. Not yet.
How about Erie?
No, not yet.
I ain't going to St. Vincent. Never, ever again.
They will be having tests out there, but it's the problem is a lot of the tests...
Well, they will be. What good is that?
Well, the problem is it's a new virus. It's a new strain.
But they do have kits. They just don't have them everywhere.
They're producing them right here in the United States right now, last I knew.
Well, that's good.
But
we have to buy those from China, too?
No.
China has, you know, it supplies us with 97% of the generic medicines.
Yep.
Isn't that, I mean...
A lot of antibiotics come from China.
Trump was always saying about we can't be held hostage by China like this, and he wants, you know, stop giving them all our information and our technology and this and that. And now I know what he's talking about, because if we're getting that much of our medicine... Rare earth? I mean, it's illegal in this country to make magnets for our guided missiles.
Yeah.
We got to buy them from China.
It used to be in the 80s and before, medicine was produced by the United States and Japan. The U.S. and Japan.
Germany, too.
Yeah, U.S. and Japan and Germany had something like 90% of the market, and now it's flipped.
China's just taken over. I mean, even India buys their medicine from China.
Yeah, but now a lot of manufacturers going to India, so it's kind of switching over to them.
Well, it should. I mean, there's certain things that we can't be held hostage like that.
Right.
It's just not right.
We need competition.
It's crazy. I mean, you can't, how do you defend yourself?
We need competition in the market.
They could just shut us off.
That's true. They could.
Jeez.
There is some evidence that China's flooding the market with opioids, and
why not? They can make a buck. What do they care?
Well, the opium wars. We can go back to that, But
all right, there you go.
But no, there's another segment about the influenza.
They're just doing it legally now. That's all.
Right.
It was illegal back then.
That's true. That's
Jeez.
True. You said you have another segment with.
I can't remember what, but it just explains more, talks more about the, and then the third one I have really goes deep into, it's probably 10 minutes or so, but it really explains it very plainly, really, it, like I say, opened my eyes. I couldn't believe that was in our history and I never heard of it.
Right. And these are the two segments on the Spanish flu that happened in 1918 to 1920. I expanded to 1920 because there are still residuals that were coming on for that.
Yeah.
But the next one, why the Spanish flu was deadlier than World War One.
Yeah.
So that's a interesting tidbit there. Many young soldiers.
Well, they talk about the burning of manure in Kansas, and
right.
The big yellow clouds of smoke that just covered everything, and they really seriously thought that that's how it started or how it got going. I'm not sure how that makes sense.
No, I don't know. It's a virus, so who knows?
It comes from animals, and who knows?
Right.
All right. Well, let's listen to that.
Okay.
In 2017, more than 37% of adults in the U.S. got a flu shot. Roughly 80,000 died from the virus in the U.S. But in 1918, there was no flu shot, and at least 50 million people died around the world. That flu was known as the Spanish flu, and it is the second deadliest plague in history, after, the plague in the 1300s. So how exactly did a flu virus cause such massive death and destruction across the world? Well, it helps to pinpoint where it started. Except we can't, not with 100% certainty. It could have been the disease-stricken trenches of World War I. Or maybe the Shaanxi province of China, where the outbreak of a respiratory disease in 1917 may have actually been the flu virus. Or maybe even Camp Funston, a military base in Kansas where 48 soldiers died of flu-like symptoms right before an outbreak. What we do know for sure is that the Spanish flu didn't start in Spain. So then why is it called the Spanish flu? Well, the flu broke out during World War I. Neither the Allied nor Central Powers wanted to admit to additional loss of life during a conflict that hinged on who had more manpower. So, all the nations involved in the war limited reports of the outbreak. In the US, some people were even afraid that reporting the flu might violate the Sedition Act of 1918, a law that prohibited disloyal language about the government and any action against the prosecution of the war. But Spain wasn't in World War I, and since they had no reason to hide anything, they reported their flu-related deaths. Even the King of Spain, Alfonso XIII, got the disease, but ultimately survived. So with the spotlight on Spain, US and European news outlets nicknamed it the Spanish flu. But the flu was spreading well outside of Spain, and with the large scale of infections going unreported, no one was prepared for the deadly pandemic it would become. Today, we know the flu is a highly contagious viral infection that spreads to the nose, throat, and sometimes the lungs. Symptoms such as fever, nausea, aches, and a sore throat are all standard. It's a terrible, possibly fatal disease that confines the afflicted to bed for days. But the 1918 flu was worse. Dark spots would appear on the body before the skin turned blue from a lack of oxygen in their blood. And patients would bleed from their noses and ears as they suffocated on their own blood and fluids. In 1918 at Camp Funston, U.S. Army doctor Roy Grist remarked, "It is only a matter of a few hours then until death comes. And it is simply a struggle for air until they suffocate. It is horrible." The outbreak at Camp Funston affected more than 1,000 soldiers, and around 40 died. But those 1,000 were part of 1 million soldiers throughout the United States who were all in contact with one another. Those soldiers were then sent overseas in the spring of 1918, carrying flu microbes that would spread faster than the war itself. In the fall of that same year, a second wave of flu cases started spreading across the U.S., hitting both military and civilian centers. Doctors had never before seen such a deadly strain of influenza. To make matters worse, knowledge of viruses at the time was limited, since microscopes of the day were not powerful enough to see them. People began blaming the Germans, claiming they were spreading poison clouds or that Bayer, which was a German-owned company, had infected their aspirin. As the flu spread in America, even public health officials began to lie about the state of things. Like Philadelphia's public health director Wilmer Crewson, who in September of 1918 declared, "No concern whatever is felt," after a Navy ship from Boston arrived with infected passengers. The next day, 2 sailors died. The day after that, 14. There was little to be done to stop the spread of the virus. Doctors had no way to create a vaccine, antiviral drugs, or even antibiotics for secondary infections like pneumonia. Instead, most prevention efforts focused on quarantine and personal hygiene. Schools, churches, and other public gathering spaces were shut down in many cities. In San Francisco, they went so far as to fine people $5 who didn't wear protective masks, dubbing them mask slackers. And in the end, after only 1 year, the death toll was catastrophic. To put things in perspective, more than 16 million people died in World War I. The Spanish flu killed at least 50 million people, and some believe the number may be closer to 100 million. In the US alone, 675,000 people would die from the flu. That's more American deaths than American soldiers who died in World War I. It's more than all the deaths of American soldiers in the 20th century combined. And in October of 1918, 195,000 Americans died, making it one of the deadliest months in U.S. history. Death was so prevalent between the war and flu that life expectancy in the U.S. dropped by 12 years. Even Woodrow Wilson was affected by the Spanish flu, having collapsed during the Versailles Peace Conference with flu-like symptoms. The outbreak of Spanish flu is what spurred the development of a vaccine, although scientists didn't even isolate the influenza virus for study until 1933, 15 years later. The first flu vaccine was developed in 1938 and was later given to U.S. soldiers in World War II. After the war, it was finally used to treat the American public.
This is the Real BS Show. We're coming back at you. Seth, you've got some information about, I mean, history before 1918, you know, maybe 500 years before.
Well, we can get to that after this next segment.
Right. Well,
with the Spanish flu.
This next section is like a warning from history.
Right.
And they delve deep into, and I think it'll really explain everything. There might be some overlap from what we've already heard, but they'll explain it better, you know.
Right, right.
That'll complete our killer virus pandemic of 1918.
Right.
Topic. And then when we're done with that, I'd really like, I don't know anything about the history of the flu before that.
Right. Well, there's,
and you've got some information about that.
So. There's many different other viruses. The ones I got aren't even the flu. They're whole separate viruses or bacteria that got spread. So we'll just say they're general diseases that got spread through bacteria or virus. And it's quite actually shocking what many of them were.
Yeah.
But
I mean, Columbus came over and he just...
And Cortez, yeah, a bunch of
Cortez,
them came over.
And then up in America, you know, United States, I mean, we wiped out a lot of Indians.
Right.
Native Americans with not bullets, but disease.
No,
yeah.
Yep.
And I don't think that's been... At least I didn't know. My history lessons didn't include that.
Right.
Include that information, you know. So I think you got a lot to tell us. I mean, you know, I'd like to hear about it, you know.
Yeah. I definitely want to spend a little bit of time unpacking that a little bit because...
Yeah, right.
It's actually quite interesting that the general public doesn't know... I mean, there is truth to what they were taught in school, but it's not the whole truth by far. And
they left a lot out.
A very large percentage of the deaths in North America and South America were not malice.
Yeah.
You know, there wasn't evil intent done. It's just there was evil intent in those times, but we'll get to that, you know?
Yeah, but they accidentally... It got crazy. So, okay, let's listen to this last bit of the killer virus of 1918, and then we'll go from there. Okay?
Sounds good.
I had a little bird. Its name was Enza. I opened the window, and in flew Enza.
Perhaps until recently, Spanish flu has been what some people call a forgotten pandemic. But it was a huge global calamity. In terms of the number of deaths, we're saying 50 to 100 million, far greater than the casualties of the First World War. Roughly around April, May 1918, when, you know, the carnage of the First World War is graphic and horrendous. But at the same time, this unknown enemy is starting to sweep through the US, Europe, the trenches. And it is recorded by the Spanish press and it becomes dubbed as the Spanish flu because they are neutral. Well, at the time in the 1920s, they estimated that maybe 20 million had died. By the late 20th century, that figure had been up to 25 million. In the 21st century, with scientists and historians now getting together to work much more closely, that figure has now been upped to 50 to 100 million people killed. This virus killed more people in the first 25 weeks than HIV/AIDS has killed in 25 years. Horrendous. I mean, those mortality statistics are staggering.
We don't know exactly why some flu strains are much more severe than others and why some of them would be more likely to kill people or cause very severe disease.
What is particular about avian and pandemic viruses is that they replicate deep inside our lungs. When our cells detect this and trigger a very strong innate immune response, this leads to an influx of white blood cells and fluids into our lungs, and it restricts the amount of airspace that we have to breathe.
The symptoms are very graphic and very, very striking. So, you know, it's said that some people drowned in their own phlegm. So if it was hitting or affecting the lungs, people were spurting blood from their ears and their noses. Descriptions of people turning blue or purple. So, you know, it was really, really severe. And people were just dropping down in the streets. Those that succumbed to the flu were in the age group 20 to 40 years, which is very unusual for an influenza epidemic or pandemic. And scientists and historians are now still looking to see why.
There's really two ways that people died in 1918. They either died from the initial flu infection, or they died from an enormously strong immune response to that virus, where their lungs just filled up with fluids from trying to attack the virus that got into their lungs.
So traditionally, everyone sort of said, oh, well, it's the trenches, and, you know, the conditions of the war, and that's why it was so fatal. But then you think, well, you know, how did it spread so rapidly around the world to places that are not part of the theatre of war? I think the traditional explanation is it starts in Kansas, in an army camp, and then the troops bring it over to the trenches of Europe. But there's still many, many unknowns.
So mathematical modellers have long been interested in the 1918 pandemic, and one of the questions is to try and disentangle how it spread around the world and exactly what the roots have been. Given perfect data, you could work backwards and try to infer where it's come from. Whereabouts does it arrive in a country? Does it arrive multiple times? Or thinking about multiple countries, where is the first place? If you understand the origin of a pandemic, then you understand something about where it's come from, and maybe you can stop that in future.
Almost certainly it was a bird flu originally. But then we also know that that flu, or something very similar to it, was in pigs at the same time. Maybe it's somebody who works very closely with birds, or who works very closely with pigs, or has some other exposure like that. One of the big, really open questions in flu research and flu public health is, how does the virus adapt from one species to another? How does, for example, a virus in pigs or in birds get into humans and then start transmitting? Then the key question is, how does the virus then adapt within that person to stop being a pig virus or a bird virus and become a human virus? In other words, to be able to transmit from human to human. And it's probably some very quick evolutionary process that is going on within that human, and in many cases won't be successful, but in a few cases will, and that's when the virus can start spreading between humans and become a flu pandemic and then stay in humans as regular seasonal flu.
Just as people were celebrating Armistice Day, there was hope that it was dying down, but then it resurged, and a far more deadly and virulent strain emerged. So this second wave really spread like wildfire, affecting a third or a quarter of the population of the world. And it was short-lived, so it petered out not long afterwards, maybe 1920, 1921. But it was in the sense, short-lived.
What happened was is that virus continued to transmit among humans. In fact, it continued until 1957 to transmit between humans. And probably what happened there is that the virus adapted to humans. It wasn't this avian or swine virus that came in and was accidentally more pathogenic in humans. In our lab here in Cambridge, we study both seasonal flu and pandemic flu from the standpoint of how does the virus evolve? And how can we predict that evolution and make vaccines to try to artificially evolve the virus, both in the laboratory and in the computer, to understand what it's going to do next and to make vaccines against those strains that will evolve in the future. So this is the basic science of studying evolution and trying to predict that evolution, something that nobody's ever been able to do for a complex organism. And then working to use that understanding to make better vaccines. On the pandemic flu side, we do a similar thing where we look to see how that virus is changing, that virus, how it changes in birds and how it changes in, how that virus changes in other species, and to try to see what possible variants out there might be. And again, to make vaccines that could protect against all of those variants that we see.
Flu is very difficult to eradicate because it's constantly mutating and changing its genetic information. We work on the influenza virus, and in particular on the enzyme that copies the genetic information of the virus when it enters our cells. Specifically, we're interested in how this enzyme can do this activity and how it inserts mutations in the viral genome that leads to the formation of new strains to which we need to develop new vaccines. And we are also interested in when this enzyme messes up, how it triggers the innate immune system and helps cause disease.
We really don't know why we haven't seen a pandemic as deadly as the 1918 pandemic. Scientists and public health officials are extremely concerned. The National Risk Register, which is the way that our government plans what are all the risks to civil society in the UK, there's only two events that are up there in terms of the most catastrophic, and that's a terrorist event or a influenza pandemic. There is a real threat that there can be such pandemics. For example, the H5 and the H7 flu viruses that have infected now close to 2,000 people and killed about half of them. There has been with the H7 viruses some transmission from human to human, not very efficient, and it hasn't really taken off. If either of those viruses did adapt to really transmit well between humans, there's a real concern that it could be as bad as the 1918 virus. And this is why there is so much research done for the public good to try to understand what's happening, and so much work done by people in public health and preparing in hospitals in case something like that happens.
Well, experts like to say it's not if, but when. Coming as a mathematician, it's happened a lot of times in the past. It'll probably happen again. The 1918 pandemic is difficult because of lack of data, but the most recent influenza pandemic we had was in 2009. And from that pandemic, there is some very good data. If we understand how the 2009 pandemic spread, maybe that tells us something we can use to help control future pandemics. If we can't stop them, the alternative is at least to allocate our resources better to try and reduce the number of cases in each place.
Looking back 100 years to the last pandemic also invites the question of 100 years from now, what will we be like in terms of how well we are protected against flu, or what things we could do to protect ourselves in some situations? Surely we'll be in a situation where we know more about what viruses are in the world and where they are. Surveillance will be so much better. Surely we'll be in a better situation where we have better drugs and better vaccines because we know more about the virus, so we know more about its weaknesses. We know more about our immune systems, and we know how to enable them to fight those pathogens better. At some point, we will have a universal vaccine that will protect us against flu for the rest of our lives. When this is a whole other question. There are a great number of approaches and really good ideas to doing this. There are already attempts at this that are at a quite advanced stage. It might be 10 years from now. It might be 20 or 30 or 40 years from now. We really don't know.
This is the Real BS Show, trying to enlighten everybody on what all this noise is about a coronavirus. Seth, that's about all I have, you know, as far as my astonishing information this week.
Right.
And but you have information about things that have happened before that.
Right.
That were, you know, devastating, terrible. So I don't know, you know, between viruses and bacteria, I'm not the blue bonnet, the black, what do you call it, the black plague?
The black plague or the blue bonnet plague, same
bacteria,
thing.
Bacteria, yeah. You know,
yeah,
rats,
bacteria.
Rats and...
Yeah, fleas.
What do you call it? Germs, I guess. I don't know.
Yeah. Fleas. The fleas spread the bubonic plague. That's what the one hypothesis is. And it's been tested. A lot of grave sites have been dug up from that time period in mass graves, and they dug them up and tested them, and it came back positive for the bacteria that I can't even pronounce what the bacteria's name is. But if you look it up, it's a well-known bacteria that's still around. If you go to the Midwest, there's... Perry dogs, you know, you ever see a
Perry? Yeah,
they have the bubonic plague. And rats in Europe were spreading it with the fleas. And there's many theories about why that happened and how it spread. But first, we're going to get into the past, the present, and the future. That's what this one episode is going to go on about, and kind of break it down. What's the threat level and how bad it was? At one point, it killed 50% of Europeans. Wow. And you know, we talk about this, the Spanish flu, or we'll call it the Kansas flu, the influenza H1N1. This, the bubonic plague, was a bacteria that was spread by fleas because they killed a bunch of cats and dogs in Europe, and that's how it spread. It came from probably China or India or somewhere, or in Central Asia somewhere. It was during the Silk Trade, the Silk Road, and this spread through like wildfire through Europe, and they were burning bodies.
Yeah, I remember reading about that.
Yeah, so
it was really bad.
And it changed Europe. I mean, we have the DNA. It's in our DNA now. We're survivors of that. And we'll get into later on how that all those different viruses and bacteria that we carry went to, when our ancestors came to the Americas, how that affected the Native Americans. But we'll get to that later.
All right. You're past my research level here.
Right. This stuff fascinates me.
Yeah,
because it's just so disturbing in some ways, and it kind of gives me a little bit. You know, I know there's a lot of people, getting ill and dying from the coronavirus, but it kind of gives me at ease that it's not as bad as it could have been.
Yeah, it used to be. Well, I mean, if you don't learn about history, you're very likely to repeat it. You know,
right.
So. It's good to know.
Right.
Good to know what happened back then. All right. I'm all ears. Take it away.
Imagine if half the people in your neighborhood, your city, or even your whole country were wiped out. It might sound like something out of an apocalyptic horror film, but it actually happened in the 14th century during a disease outbreak known as the Black Death. Spreading from China through Asia, the Middle East, Africa, and Europe, the devastating epidemic destroyed as much as one-fifth of the world's population, killing nearly 50% of Europeans in just 4 years. One of the most fascinating and puzzling things about the Black Death is that the illness itself was not a new phenomenon, but one that has affected humans for centuries. DNA analysis of bone and tooth samples from this period, as well as an earlier epidemic known as the Plague of Justinian in 541 CE, has revealed that both were caused by Yersinia pestis, the same bacterium that causes bubonic plague today. What this means is that the same disease caused by the same pathogen can behave and spread very differently throughout history. Even before the use of antibiotics, the deadliest outbreaks in modern times, such as the ones that occurred in early 20th century India, killed no more than 3% of the population. Modern instances of plague also tend to remain localized or travel slowly, as they are spread by rodent fleas. But the medieval Black Death, which spread like wildfire, was most likely communicated directly from one person to another. And because genetic comparisons of ancient and modern strains of Yersinia pestis have not revealed any significantly functional genetic differences, the key to why the earlier outbreak was so much deadlier must lie not in the parasite, but the host. For about 300 years during the High Middle Ages, a warmer climate and agricultural improvements had led to explosive population growth throughout Europe. But with so many new mouths to feed, the end of this warm period spelled disaster. High fertility rates combined with reduced harvests meant the land could no longer support its population, while the abundant supply of labor kept wages low. As a result, most Europeans in the early 14th century experienced a steady decline in living standards, marked by famine, poverty, and poor health, leaving them vulnerable to infection. And indeed, the skeletal remains of Black Death victims found in London show telltale signs of malnutrition and prior illness. The destruction caused by the Black Death changed humanity in two important ways. On a societal level, the rapid loss of population led to important changes in Europe's economic conditions. With more food to go around, as well as more land and better pay for the surviving farmers and workers, people began to eat better and live longer, as studies of London cemeteries have shown. Higher living standards also brought an increase in social mobility, weakening feudalism, and eventually leading to political reforms. But the plague also had an important biological impact. The sudden death of so many of the most frail and vulnerable people left behind a population with a significantly different gene pool, including genes that may have helped survivors resist the disease. And because such mutations often confer immunities to multiple pathogens that work in similar ways, research to discover the genetic consequences of the Black Death has the potential to be hugely beneficial. Today, the threat of an epidemic on the scale of the Black Death has been largely eliminated thanks to antibiotics. But the bubonic plague continues to kill a few thousand people worldwide every year. And the recent emergence of a drug-resistant strain threatens the return of darker times. Learning more about the causes and effects of the Black Death is important, not just for understanding how our world has been shaped by the past. It may also help save us from a similar nightmare in the future.
This is the Real BS Show. And Seth, you take it away. Remember I said learn about history?
Right.
So you don't repeat it?
Yeah.
Well, that's what that lady was just saying.
Right.
And hopefully they won't forget about these things. And it seems like they did forget about them, and nothing's really changed.
Yeah.
There's some better medicine now, but they still haven't figured it out.
We talked about the Iranian health minister last episode, and now quite a few Iranian ministers have died from the coronavirus.
They have a problem over there because they said they don't want to deal with medicine. They're too religious.
Right.
So if God wants them to die, that's fine. That's their solution.
It's tough because, you know, going to this next segment, I do have to preface, I am not in denial of what Europeans did to Native Americans, but it pales in comparison to what they didn't know they did. Sometimes
they did by accident.
They did by accident without knowing. And a few things I want to say beforehand, this is just from my historical knowledge, is there's only been one case where it was written down that they definitively handed a smallpox blanket to a Native American group on purpose. The British did. Besides that, it didn't happen besides that one time of us knowing. It's not written anywhere else. They would have written about it. They would have bragged about that because that's what they did.
Germ warfare.
But what this next segment goes into is how 90% of Native Americans died. And many of them died without any European contact. Whole villages were wiped completely empty of people.
Now you're talking smallpox.
That's right.
Now that's a virus?
That's a virus. There was many viruses.
It's not a bacteria. It's a
virus, yeah.
Virus.
But there was many viruses and bacteria that came. But smallpox was... There was many epidemics that happened in North America and South America.
I mean, the Black Plague was germs.
That was germs, yep.
And, rats and fleas and whatnot.
Right.
And the smallpox was a virus.
Yep. This is one of many viruses, part of what's called the Columbian Exchange. And when Europeans came to North America and South America and Central America, they brought with them many viruses and bacteria from being exposed to animals in their houses to being around different environments, and they gave them to Native Americans unknowingly. And so there's a saying, don't attribute to malice what can be attributed to stupidity. And this parallels today, where in the Indian government does not allow people to go to an island called the North Sentinelese Island because there's uncontacted people there that are not immune. They lack immunity to all these modern diseases, and they know now, they're smart and saying, don't go to this island, stay away from it, because these people will get wiped out. There's like 100 people on this island, and they have arrows and they're shooting helicopters, and they don't want people on their island. And so we're trying to, and they're facing it in the Amazon with uncontacted tribes where they're like being very careful approaching them, how to integrate them back into society, because many of them do want to come back into modern society. But many don't. And so there's this issue. Many are getting sick when they do have contact. So in this segment, we're going into, you know, what happened with the smallpox and many other viruses and bacteria that Europeans gave and spread like wildfire through North America and South America and Central America. And it's probably why all the major empires that were in the Americas ended. It was a big factor.
See, like when I was growing up in history class, I don't ever remember anything about that
right,
kind of stuff.
Right.
You know, it was always shooting and, you know, everybody's fighting with each other.
Right.
You know? But there was a lot more going on.
Right.
And okay, well, let's give a listen.
Between the first Europeans arriving in 1492 and the Victorian age, the indigenous population of the New World dropped by at least 90%. The cause? Not the conquistadors and company. They killed lots of people, but their death count is nothing compared to what they brought with them. Smallpox, typhus, tuberculosis, influenza, bubonic plague, cholera, mumps, measles, and more leapt from those first explorers to the coastal tribes, then onward the microscopic invaders spread through a hemisphere of people with no defenses against them. Tens of millions died. These germs decided the fate of these battles long before the fighting started. Now ask yourself, why didn't the Europeans get sick? If New Worlders were vulnerable to Old World diseases, then surely Old Worlders would be vulnerable to New World diseases. Yet there was no America pox spreading eastward, infecting Europe, and cutting the population from 90 million to 9. Had America pox existed, it would have rather dampened European ability for transatlantic expansion. To answer why this didn't happen, we need first to distinguish regular diseases like the common cold from what we'll call plagues. First, plagues spread quickly between people. Sneezes spread plagues faster than handshakes, which are faster than closeness. Plagues use more of this than this. Secondly, and importantly, they kill you quickly or you become immune. Catch a plague and you're dead within 7 to 30 days. Survive and you'll never get it again. Your body has learned to fight it. You might still carry it. The plague lives in you. You can spread it, but it can't hurt you. The surface answer to this question isn't that Europeans had better immune systems to fight off New World plagues. It's that the New World didn't have plagues for them to catch. They had regular diseases, but there was no America pox to carry. These are history's biggest killers, and they all come from the Old World. But why? Let's dig deeper and talk cholera. A plague that spreads if your civilization does a bad job of separating drinking water from pooping water. London was terrible at this, making it the cholera capital of the world. Cholera can rip through dense neighborhoods, killing swaths of the population before moving onward. But that's the key. It has to move on. In a small, isolated group, a plague like cholera cannot survive. It kills all available victims, leaving only the immune, and then there's nowhere to go. It's a fire that burns through its fuel. But a city, shining city on the hill, to which rural migrants flock, where hundreds of babies are born a day, this is sanctuary for the fire of plague. Fresh kindling comes to it. The plague flares and smolders and flares and smolders again, impossible to extinguish. Historically, in city borders, plagues killed faster than people could breed. Cities grew because more people moved to them than died inside of them. Cities only started growing from their own population in the 1900s, when medicine finally left its leeches and bloodletting phase and entered its soap and soup phase, giving humans some tools to slow death. But before that, a city was an unintentional playground for plagues and a grim machine to sort the immune from the rest. So the deeper answer is that the New World didn't have plagues because the New World didn't have big, dense, terribly sanitized, deeply interconnected cities for plagues to thrive. Okay, But the New World wasn't completely barren of cities, and tribes weren't completely isolated. Otherwise, the newly arrived smallpox in the 1400s couldn't have spread. Cities are only part of the puzzle. They're required for plagues, but cities don't make the germs that start the plagues. Those germs come from the missing piece. Now, most germs don't want to kill you for the same reason you don't want to burn down your house. Germs live in you. Chronic diseases like leprosy are terrible because they're very good at living in you and not killing you. Plague lethality is an accident, a misunderstanding, because the germs that cause plagues don't know they're in humans. They think they're in this. Plagues come from animals. Whooping cough comes from pigs, as does flu, as well as from birds. Our friend the cow alone is responsible for measles, tuberculosis, and smallpox. For the cow, these diseases are no big deal, like colds for us. But when cow germs get in humans, the things they do to make a cow a little sick to spread make humans very sick, deadly sick. Now, germs jumping species is extraordinarily rare. That's why generations of humans can spend time around animals just fine. Being the patient zero of a new animal-to-human plague is winning a terrible lottery. But a colonial-age city raises the odds. There used to be animals everywhere. Horses, herds of livestock in the streets, open slaughterhouses, meat markets pre-refrigeration, and rivers of human and animal excrement running through it all. A more perfect environment for diseases to jump species could hardly be imagined. So the deeper answer is that plagues come from animals, but so rarely that you have to raise the odds with many chances for infection. And even then, the newborn plague needs a fertile environment to grow. The old world had the necessary pieces in abundance. But why was a city like London filled with sheep and pigs and cows and Tenochtitlan wasn't? This brings us to the final level, for this video anyway. Some animals can be put to human use. This is what domestication means. Animals you can breed, not just hunt. Forget for a moment the modern world. Go back to 10,000 BC when tribes of humans reached just about everywhere. If you were in one of these tribes, what local animals could you capture alive and successfully pen to breed? Maybe you're in North Dakota and thinking about catching a buffalo, an unpredictable, violent tank on hooves that can outrun you across the plains, leap over your head, and travels in herds thousands strong. Oh, and you have no horses to help you because there are no horses on the continent. Horses live here and won't be brought over until too late. It's just you, a couple buddies, and stone-based tools. American Indians didn't fail to domesticate buffalo because they couldn't figure it out. They failed because it's a buffalo. No one could do it. Buffalo would have been amazing creatures to put to human work back in BC, but it's not going to happen. Humans have only barely domesticated buffalo with all of our modern tools. The New World didn't have good animal candidates for domestication. Almost everything big enough to be useful is also too dangerous or too agile. Meanwhile, the Fertile Crescent to Central Europe had cows and pigs and sheep and goats, easy peasy animals comparatively begging to be domesticated. A wild boar is something to contend with if you have only stone tools, but it's possible to catch and pen and breed and feed to eat, because pigs can't leap to the sky or crush all resistance beneath their hooves. In the New World, the only native domestication contestant was llamas. They're better than nothing, which is probably why the biggest cities existed in South America, but they're no cow. Ever try to manage a herd of llamas in the mountains of Peru? Yeah, you can do it, but it's not fun. Nothing but drama, these llamas. These might seem cherry-picked examples, because aren't there hundreds of thousands of species of animals? Yes, but when you're stuck at the bottom of the tech tree, almost none of them can be domesticated. From the dawn of man until this fateful meeting, humans domesticated maybe a baker's dozen of unique species the world over. And even to get to that high a number, you need to stretch it to include honeybees and silkworms. Nice to have, but you can't build a civilization civilization on a foundation of honey alone. These early tribes weren't smarter or better at domestication. The old world had more valuable and easy animals. With dogs, herding sheep and cattle is easier. Now humans have a buddy to keep an eye on the clothing factory and the milk and cheeseburger machine and the plow puller. Now farming is easier, which means there's more benefit to staying put, which means more domestication, which means more food, which means more people and more density. And oh, look where we're going. Citiesville. Population lots bring your animals, plagues welcome. That is the full answer. The lack of new world animals to domesticate limited not only exposure to germ sources, but also limited food production, which limited population growth, which limited cities, which made plagues in the new world an almost impossibility. In the old, exactly the reverse, and thus a continent full of plague and a continent devoid of it. So when ships landed in the new world, there was no America pox to bring back. The game of civilization has nothing to do with the players and everything to do with the map. Access to domesticated animals in numbers and diversity is the key resource to bootstrapping a complex society from nothing. And that complexity brings with it, unintentionally, a passive biological weaponry devastating to outsiders. Start the game again, but move the domesticatable animals across the sea, and history's arrow of disease and death flows in the opposite direction.
Welcome back to the Real BS Show. Seth, I don't know about you, but this has been the most interesting, unbelievable show I think we've done.
Right.
I mean, I'm still dumbfounded by all this information. Maybe folks like music better than information. I don't know, but
right.
For me, it's been something else. What a learning experience. Wow.
There's always something out there to learn about. That's for sure.
Well, I think history is very important. It's even more important to me now.
I think about the past and a lot, and it keeps me kind of calm knowing that we have modern medicine. There's still a lot of improvement to be done, but you know, you go back 5 or 10,000 years ago, you didn't have much life expectancy if you got sick or a virus. I mean, things were not good, and there's a reason why people didn't trust the strangers over the hill coming, because they might be carrying disease,
yeah,
you know, or weapons, but mostly disease, you know. But at the same time, now we have knowledge of what viruses and germs are and bacteria, you know. We know how to wash our hands and don't touch your face.
So in the face of all this, what's your advice? I mean, should we get nutty and crazy? Like, I see people walking around Walmart with masks on already. And some of them are just dust masks from they stole from the factory.
Those aren't going to protect you. Even the N95, you know, or the N900s, N100 masks, those aren't going to protect you because you're not wearing goggles on over your eyes. If someone's coughing or sneezing, it's going to get everywhere.
So washing your hands.
Wash your hands.
That's a good idea.
Yeah. And then you can use antibacterial
soap. Disinfectant.
Disinfectant. You know, you can use rubbing alcohol to clean your, you know, things, surfaces. Bleach does work. But, you know, if you sneeze or cough, cover yourself with your increase of your elbow. You know, don't use your hands or wash your hands after you sneeze if you have to. But prevention is not that hard, you know?
Yeah. Well, you know, common sense, I guess, and maybe that's in short supply. I don't know. Normalcy bias, you know, can't happen here. So.
Right.
But I think be careful, because it can happen here.
Oh, easily. It has.
I mean, we're talking about an enemy you can't even see, you know?
Right.
I mean, some big dude with a knife or a pistol, you can see that.
Right.
You can't see a virus.
Right.
So everybody, wash your hands. Don't sneeze on your friends and your family and
or your enemies.
Or your food. But just use common sense. Hey, let's say goodnight and we'll see y'all next week. How's that?
Sounds good.
All right. Thanks, Seth. That was very interesting.
All right. Have a good night, Bill.
We'll see you.